Hey, this is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and thanks for tuning into another of our virtual events. And we're delighted to have two of our favorite authors here with us today. Paul, I'm going to blow the last name because we were just talking about Dwaron, a.k.a. Hercule Dwaron. His brand new book, Hatchet Island. And as always, Paul was kind enough to sign a batch of books for us. Got some right there. And I'll put a link to this in the comments field should you like to purchase one. And also joining us today is our good friend Sarah Stewart Taylor, who has a brand new book out called The Drowning Sea. And she also has signed a bunch of books for us. So there we go. Very stylized signature there. looks great. I'll put a link to that as well in the comments field. We don't have too many signed copies of either of these books left. So also, if you have questions for Paul or Sarah, go ahead and put those in as they occur to you, and I'll be happy to ask them. Barbara usually brings me back on screen towards the end of the hour. So Barbara, over to you.
Thanks very much, Patrick. I'm so pleased to see both of you. This is yet a new pairing. I'm going to say it wrong too. Poirot, which is like Poirot, because the OI in French is pronounced wa. So I'm going to call him Hercule from now on. It's always a joy to see him and Sarah as well. So I've developed some commonalities that I wanted them to talk about, but let's start with the covers, because if you look very carefully, they're the same palette. I mean, it really is this sort of lovely greens and blues and sort of seascapes, and it's wonderful. And then Sarah's, they very thoughtfully made it kind of blurry, which I think is intended to sort of convey the idea of being underwater or drowning. Sarah, did anybody tell you why it's so blurry?
But, you know, it's interesting that the type on all three of the Maggie Darcy books has that sort of blown out look to it. And I like it. I think it's really, I don't know, there's something unsettling about it, which is what I think is meant to come across, you know, that it's sort of this traditional landscape, and yet there's something very unsettling and disturbing about the type.
It is, I agree. And it's got a lovely representation. Excuse me, you may barely be able to see it up there, but notice the house on the cliff, which will be important as we talk about it. Now, Paul has written a pelagic mystery. I love it. I've never been able to say that before. There, you will notice the birds. And there's a very nice little anecdote in the back of the bio on this, which I will let Hercule here tell you about why he got interested in birding.
Okay, right now?
Sure, why not?
Oh, wow. All right. Many years ago, I met a young woman who I was very attracted to, and she said, if you want to date me, you need to take up birding, because I'm a fanatical birder, and that's what we're going to be doing. And I really wanted to be with her, and so I tagged along, and 20 something years later, we're married, and I'm not a bad birder.
Do you have a life 26. List? Do you have a life list? You do?
I do. Yeah. I couldn't tell you how many birds I have on it, although she knows, I'm sure. I wouldn't have kept at it for so long if I didn't enjoy it. Birds are amazing creatures, and it's been fun actually to watch people in the pandemic discover birding. You know, it's really boomed. So there's one thing.
When they didn't go back to reading, right? No, that's wonderful. So in order to really enjoy birds, Paul has created a windswept eerie island off the coast of Maine, which he calls Hatchet Island. But is it based in part on Hurricane Island?
Well, there's several islands actually in the book, and they're all fictional. So Hatchet is based on Hurricane Island, which was a granite quarry. It figures a little bit late in the second half of the book. The Seabird Island is actually called Baker Island. There are several Baker Islands in Maine. This one does not exist. And it probably is closest to Eastern Egg Rock, which is where puffins, North Atlantic puffins, were Atlantic puffins were reintroduced to the United States by Dr. Stephen Kress, who was an acclaimed ornithologist, and I had the privilege of being guided on the island at one stage. This was before I ever got interested in writing this particular book, but got to be in the blinds and, you know, watching puffins at my feet. And it really is an amazing experience to be surrounded by birds that way.
It really is. I'm addicted to puffins. I spent a lot of time cruising up in the Arctic and so forth and puffins. Oh, yeah. I almost lost my younger daughter, who in Iceland decided that she would go over a cliff in order to photograph the puffins. She wanted to work for a photograph, but I was trying to figure out how I was ever going to explain to her husband and her father that I lost her in the Atlantic while she was photographing puffins. But anyway, and, there we are.
I'm making a segue here. There are puffins, of course, in Ireland, the west coast of Ireland.
Right.
And my sort of the chief ornithologist in the book studied in the skellugs.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Which Sarah can explain what those are.
Yeah. So they are a beautiful, beautiful group of islands off the west coast of Ireland. And one of them, Skellig Michael, has become quite famous because, of course, it's where they shot all of the Luke Skywalker in retirement scenes in the newer Star Wars movies. And it was actually when I was researching the Drowning Sea, I was in a part of Ireland where they'd shot some other scenes in the movie, Browhead in West Cork. And it was, you know, you could sort of see how all of the Star Wars related tourism had, you know, I think was both welcomed and there was a slight annoyance about all of the people looking for Luke Skywalker on the west coast of Ireland.
And if you go to the north coast where they shot Game of Thrones, there are actually, you know, whole tourist things that leave from Belfast and drive up to past the Giant's Causeway and the whole bit. Actually, Western Ireland, where I've also spent a lot of time, has a beautiful thing called the Wild Atlantic Way. I don't know if it comes down as far as Cork. I think it's more around Galway.
Yeah, well, it's sort of all along that Atlantic coast. So there definitely are parts of it in on that part, the Sheep's Head Peninsula and the beautiful, beautiful parts of West Cork there.
So my first commonality that I was going to ask you both to address was, why did you decide to set your books this time close to the sea? You know, in your case, Paulhan Islands, and in Sarah's case, in Canty Cork. So Sarah, what drew you there?
Yeah, that's such a great question. You know, West Cork is a part of Ireland that I've always loved. And I'd visited a few times, and I think I'd always sort of wanted to spend more time there. And so part of it was just this, you know, a curiosity about it and wanting to do a research trip there. It's also the part of Ireland that my family comes from. And so I knew, I'd been doing quite a lot of research, and I sort of had pinpointed the part of West Cork where my great-great-grandfather was born and lived. And so I think it was, you know, I wanted an excuse to visit that part of Ireland. But also it just seemed like a great setting for the story I wanted to tell. In this book, I take my detective main character, Maggie Darcy, to Ireland for what's supposed to be a relaxing summer vacation. She's going to spend the summer in a cottage on this beautiful peninsula with her boyfriend and her daughter and his son. And they're sort of going to try to blend their families and see if they can make this work. And Maggie's deciding if she's going to move to Ireland and try to work there. And, you know, there are a lot of things about West Cork that just sort of fit the story that I wanted to tell. It's a place that's had a lot of, you know, sort of high-end development. And I wanted a luxury hotel and a high-end development to be part of my story. It's a place that off the coast of West Cork, there have been some very high profile drug seizures on boats. And there was some really kind of interesting real life material that I use to be inspired. And then just the history in that part of Ireland. There was so much wonderful history that, you know, I kind of wanted to tap into.
So the landscape, but this coastal landscape was essential to your story. Paul, clearly if you're writing a pelagic mystery, you will do better. I just can't resist that. It's so much fun. Right.
Use that word.
It's going to work better if you're on the Maine coast rather than in the interior of Maine. So what inspired you to write Hatchet Island?
Well, I've always, of course, Maine is famously a coastal state and is best known for its coast. And I live on the coast, and I've wanted to write another book that takes place on the water. Essentially, the problem has been is that Maine game wardens have some jurisdiction on some islands, but it's a fairly limited deal. And so I had to come up with the right circumstances to justify Mike Bowditch getting involved in homicide on an offshore island. And it began taking shape years and years ago. My wife and I went to visit a seabird island, and we were greeted by the interns who were working there. This one was not super far off the coast, but many are. Many are, you know, 12, 20 miles off, and are not visited every day by supply or anything like that. But we happened to visit this particular island, and we were greeted by the interns, all of whom were these college women. And there were three of them, I think, or four of them. And we started talking to them about their experience. And it turns out, well, they were visited every day by the local lobstermen. The lobstermen would come by and they would give them ice cream and, of course, lobsters. And they said, they're so nice, these guys. And of course, my macabre imagination is imagining. It's like these women are so exposed out here alone, and it sort of planted the seed for a seabird island being the site of a crime novel someday. And a bunch of things came together. The biggest one is that actually some of these islands are managed by the same agency in Maine that the Maine Warden Service is part of. And once I realized that, I'm like, well, he has every reason in the world to be involved in this particular crime. So,
well, you wrote an earlier book in which Deer Island figured, but then that one wasn't about birds. That was about deer and the horrible plague of ticks, which I thought you despised rather graphically in that particular novel. And so, you know, you do touch on the idea both of, or not touch on, but part of your books is there has to be some economic reason for people to be there. I mean, they can't just live there for nothing. So Maggie, you've already mentioned that you're looking at high-end hotel development. I mean, Western Ireland is a natural place for tourism. But Paul, what is it that you introduce the big income thing for part of the people in the story, the bad guys, essentially?
Well, the sort of the drama that's going on off the coast of Maine right now is climate change. And it's already happened in southern New England that the lobster catch has plummeted. Yeah. Lobsters are sort of moving steadily north along the coast, and so that's going on, and it's testing, of course, these lobstering communities and individual fishermen. At the same time, we also have things like wind turbines that are being proposed for various places. One is actually off one of the big islands, the most important islands on the eastern coast, that's part of the Atlantic Flyway. It's being proposed and it's in the works. And in addition, there's a lot of controversy around right whales being entangled in fishing gear lobstering gear, the lines that are used. It's primarily a Canadian problem in terms of what they use for their gear. But there was just enough sort of, when you write a crime novel, it's always, I always find it interesting to bring some of the societal conflicts into it, and as the either the background or the motivating incident or whatever it is, and there's just, you know, you think to yourself, okay, an island with puffins on it, I mean, what can go wrong out there, right? Well, as it turns out, there's a lot going on around there, and some people are not particularly happy at this moment. So it you know gave me an opening to murder somebody, not personally.
On the page.
On the page. So both of you, in your own way, have written an Agatha Christie country house murder, by which I mean that you have created a basically closed environment. And in your case, Sarah, you've got an actual, more like Rebecca, you've got a house. You've got one of those wonderful big seaside houses. And, you know, I love mysteries that have that kind of structure, because, you know, then you get to play around with the only people in the building, you know, to quote the TV thing, but which actually is the same thing. If you think about it, the Steve Martin series, which is about to have series, you know, season two, it's the same thing. You know, the big apartment building in New York is the same idea, exactly, that the only people in the building can be responsible. So, Sarah, what you know, why the house? And did you just need money to be flowing in here in order to make your plot work?
Well, so the house in The Drowning Sea is actually an abandoned Anglo-Irish big house from, you know, from the part of Ireland's history where, you know, a mostly Protestant landowning ascendancy ruled everybody else. And, you know, so there are these houses all over Ireland, and I've always been fascinated by them. I wrote my master's thesis when I was in graduate school in Ireland on the Anglo-Irish writer Elizabeth Bowen, who famously lived in and owned her family's big house, also in County Cork, Bowen's Court. And so I had, you know, I'd done a lot of reading about the history of these houses, and so many of them were burned during, you know, the early 20th century during the War for Independence. And the ones that weren't burned had sort of a, you know, in some ways, in many cases, kind of a sadder fate, because the families that owned them, many of them left, many of them didn't have the money to keep them up anymore. And so there are these houses all over Ireland, these huge houses that, you know, many different things have happened to them. But one of the things that's happened to them is they've been bought and turned into, you know, luxury hotels and resorts and all of these things. And so I was really interested in kind of exploring that part of Ireland's history, and then looking at a place that I was just thinking that another commonality between our books is sort of the push and pull of tourism and the environment, and, you know, people having to make a living in these beautiful natural places. And, you know, just as Paul writes about the lobstermen and the conservationists and, you know, people with competing interests. I think that's what fascinated me about the story that I wanted to tell, that, you know, there the people on this peninsula are fighting against the development. And then there are others who are saying, no, if we're going to stay here, if we're going to live here, we need jobs, we need tax revenue, we need this development. And Maggie is, you know, who's on vacation there, is sort of getting to know people on both sides of this conflict, and the conflict, you know, bubbles over during the course of this story when a body is found beneath the steep cliffs.
Ooh, a body. You know, it's really important to remember that those big houses were economic engines. I mean, you know, they supported all the community around them, the people in the village and all, you know, they created, they bought their food, they employed their, you know, as servants, the whole bit. it was a mini economic environment. And when they came empty, that all went away. Mm-hmm. And so now what you're talking about is an effort to replace, to have the house generating income rather than the family with money living in the house. But to maintain a huge house like that, it took an army.
It did. And you know, one of the things that I write about in The Drowning Sea is that those houses have dark history embedded in their stones. I think any place where colonialism has, you know, has sort of created the landscape as it did in Ireland, you have that history that's in places, in stones. And can you ever really move past that? I think that's the question I'm really interested in.
That's a good point for Ireland. I mean, if you have major houses in England, they weren't colonial, but, you know, they were supported by fortunes, some of which were acquired through unhappy means. You know, some of them go all the way back to days of serfdom and so forth, but you can't have multiple generations of people living in a house without secrets and deaths and probably the occasional murder and, mm-hmm. you know, the whole bit. So mm-hmm. I love that. So Paul, in your book, there is sort of a great house, and there's a family that is supporting it. So where does their money come from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are several islands in this book. The first is the Seabird Island, and the second is an island that's owned by a very wealthy, once famous photographer. You sort of think of him as somewhere between Annie Leibovitz and Ansel Adams, and with a little bit of Andrew Wyeth sort of mm-hmm. thrown in. Where he had like a photo that everybody knew. You know, it's like, and this was inspired in my mind by, there's a famous photo by a photographer's name, of course, is escaping me, of this lighthouse being totally engulfed in this massive wave, you know, and you sort of see this picture in random places and waiting rooms and things like this. And I sort of envisioned this guy being the same way. And he's eccentric and wealthy, and his wife has decided that what she wants to do with their island is recreate the little village that was out there during the granite quarrying days. And so she has brought people out to live there. And you know, this is also based on something real. I won't get into the details of, but I, you know, that's, you mentioned, Barbara, the Agatha Christie connection. And I both read and listened to, and then there were none before I started writing this book, just because, yeah, she's, you know, she had staked out that land. I mean, the thing about islands that are so, it's so interesting, I mean, in both in fiction and in reality, is they're little, each can be this manifestation of a strange personality or a strange self-contained community. It gives you a lot to work with, because they're isolated, and usually people who end up on islands do so for a really good reason and experience. And it felt like I could portray a number of different kinds of the island cultures that exist off the coast of Maine. Everything from, you know, the rock where the seabird researchers are studying, to this former ghost town village that this wealthy genius has bought and you know, sort of runs as his own private fiefdom. And I don't know, I felt like there was a lot to, as always, there's almost too much to work with, and the issue becomes how do I focus. So
well, certainly if you're going to have people working in remote places that need serious money, artists are kind of a natural, you know, because or today tech geniuses, either way, but right. Well, that works too. But you know, forever, you know, you can have writers or painters or, you know, photographers or something whose income is not, you know, doesn't demand that they be worker bees commuting or anything, but they can live in places like your island, or as Maggie, you know, is in Ireland, you could also have same kind of people, you know, living in these big houses and supporting them.
Well, it's funny because whereas I was reading Paul's book, I another commonality is that at the center of my mystery is the woman who grew up in this now abandoned big house. And her father was a famous Irish painter. And there are, you know, I think there is something about artists and mysteries, you know, and the idea that a visual image can, you know, could hold clues or could somehow be a part of the solution to the mystery. There's just something about that. You know, there are so many mysteries. I love Nio Marsh, the Golden Age writer. And, you know, I think she used art and artists so beautifully in her books.
Well, she did, but you know, let's face it, follow the money is an absolute mantra in crime fiction. You know, I mean, the people who have the most to lose are most often the people who, you know, will do terrible things to protect,
yes,
you know, to protect what they have. If, I mean, you know, if it's a low score, if you're a fisherman, you know, and barely surviving, then, you know, you don't have a lot at stake, but, yep. So I think that, you know, money and therefore sources of money are an important thing. But you know what I really find fascinating in your books and a commonality is both of them, and Paul's developed over a longer period of time, because this is your third book, and this is Paul's, which one number is this now?
13.
13, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. 13. So what you both have are complicated relationships. Your sleuths are, you know, partnered or want to be partnered with people that present a lot of challenges and vice versa. So, you know, I think that the relationship, it really powered the story to a huge extent. And part of the suspense for the reader is, you know, will they or won't they make it? Or how are they gonna work this out? So Paul, I meant to ask you this before, and maybe I have, but you know, Stacy, you brought her in and then you split them up. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to bring her back? Did you always intend her to come back, or did you sort of run out of attractive alternatives? No, I'm serious, because he had another girlfriend there for a while whom I really liked. So yeah. Why is Stacy back in the picture, and are they going to get along any better now?
Well, frankly, Stacy, yes, it was always Stacy. It was always going to be Stacy. And when I first brought her onto the scene in some of the earlier books, she was meant to be even sort of Mike to the next degree. You know, Mike is impetuous, she's more impetuous. Mike is self-destructive, she's more self-destructive. And I did that deliberately, because I wanted to put Mike in this position of having to be the responsible one in the party. And it would be challenging to him. This problem or opportunity, I guess, that I created for myself was that, you know, it was hard for, I think, for a lot of readers to warm to Stacy, and for good reason, you know. And I realized that I wasn't doing her justice. I think Mike was seeing her, you know, through this lens, and maybe I was too. And readers actually influenced the course of this series. I was listening to them about what they liked and they didn't like, and yeah, there's no, you know, in Mike's love life, there are no villains. None of the women that he's been involved with are bad people. And but ultimately, of course, he needs to make a choice. And in this book, it starts out with a kayaking trip he's making with Stacy to this Seabird Island where she had worked in college as an intern. And that's why they're going out there initially, because her friend is is managing the place for this seabird genius who's kind of losing it and wants Stacy and Mike to kind of come and check things out, because it's things are getting very weird and sort of spooky, and people are harassing them, and so it gave me a chance also just to to sort of put them together as partners too, to sort of show what Stacy is good at, which I had not done so much in the past either. So it was really an interesting challenge for me to sort of bring her back and in a way that kept her consistent with the character I had established previously, but also showed that she had grown while away from Mike. I mean, that was the big piece of it, was that they were both growing through other relationships. So anyway,
you did that very dramatically. I still remember the boa constrictor down there in the river, or the python rather. I assume you saw the 200-pound python that has just been brought to everybody's attention, but Stacy dispatched one, I thought, rather handily when you brought her back. It was really, I was worried the snake would win. We would lose Stacy. So Sarah, Connor is actually, it's not about their personalities, it's about their locations. So you've had to work out a dynamic where you've got a person in the United States and a person in Ireland. And
yeah.
Are they having met in your first book in yep. this series? How are you going to work out a decent relationship, given the fact that their professions pretty much tie them to the place that they are when they meet?
Well, Maggie is moving to Ireland. So, the drowning sea is sort of their, their tryout, I guess you would say. But it's not too much of a spoiler to say that she really has made the decision to leave Long Island and to move to Ireland. But the big question is, will she be able to do her job in Ireland? And right. So in this book, she kind of finds out a little bit about what kind of training she'd have to do. And she's deciding whether or not she wants to do that. It's, as I discovered doing my research, an American homicide detective can't just show up in Ireland and say, okay, I'm here, I'm ready to give me a job. So she, she needs to do some fairly substantial Garda training, just the way that new recruits do. And she needs to learn Irish criminal law and all of those things. And so the book is sort of about, and that will take her away from Connor for a little while to do that training. And so, can the relationship take that? Can she move her daughter to a new place and then be away a lot? And, all of these questions kind of come up. It's funny. I did a talk with Archer Mayer on Saturday, and we were talking about character relationships. And of course, Joe Gunther's many relationships over the years. And we were saying that, when you think about the kind of relationship or partnership you'd like for yourself or for your child, you want stability and you want a healthy, functional relationship. But when you're picking relationships for your series character in crime fiction, that doesn't always work so well. You want tension and you want obstacles and you want things not to be quite so easy. I'm sure Paul has had these thoughts too. How do you keep things interesting, even when the love interest is a good person and is a, it is a love match, but how do you keep things interesting? So I think that's what I'm really thinking about right now.
Joe Gunther, the medical examiner, was always the right woman for him. After he broke up with the rape novel. I have followed Archer during his entire career, and we're actually going to talk about his new book on September 29th. He's one of my completely favorite series writers.
He's great. I love those books so much. And he's such a wonderful person too. I always have so much fun. He's such a character.
I own all of his books, which is like a shelf and a half in my library.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's
in any case, the question, part of the question is, all right, Connor has a job that he loves and he needs to be in Ireland. She has the job as a policewoman. She used to be in Long Island. Obviously your interest here is Ireland, but you know, in the real world, one of them was going to have to give up, you know, and move. So, you know, did you, you wrote the two books to really kind of close out Maggie's life in Long Island so she could move to Ireland, is the way I read it, particularly the second book.
Yeah, definitely. I started writing the second book in Ireland, and then I sort of had this realization that, you know, she's a homicide detective. She wouldn't just quit her job. Something would have to happen for her to give up her career and her life on Long Island. And so the second book, A Distant Grave, is kind of about that thing. And I, you know, I don't want to give too much away to readers, but something happens in that book that makes that, you know, I think a believable choice for her to make.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. But, you know, I thought that that's the major source of tension. The other, of course, is you've given them children, and, you know, any new blended family, children can introduce all kinds of stress, which you haven't done to Mike and Stacy. So far, Paul, at least I don't think there are any actual kids involved.
The wolf is the child.
Right. Well, that's true. Shadows. Yeah. And Stacy really bonds with Shadow in this book, which I thought was great. I love the wolf. I was worried for a while. There was one book when I thought he was a spoiler, too bad, that I thought he was going to die. And I was really upset by that. I thought you're going to dust him out of this series, but he's so great.
Oh, no. No, when mystery writers get together, we all tell each other, don't kill the dog.
Book. That's right. Cats are expendable, but not dogs.
Not dogs.
So, you know, of course, the other commonality is that somebody has to die and there has to be reasons behind it and, you know, follow the money and all the other good stuff. So those are my questions. So what would you like to ask each other? Paul, what would you like to ask Sarah?
I would, Sarah, I can't imagine writing a series set in a country in which I did not live. Mm-hmm. And it's so intimidating to me. The thought of it is so intimidating to me. Now, I know you have lived there, and you know, you go back for research and that sort of thing. But how do you does it give you, like, does you wake up in the night, you know, worried that you're going to be alienating all these Irish readers or Irish American readers who are going to be shaking their head at, you know, your depiction of the setting?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think I didn't write this series for a long time because I was so worried about getting it wrong. You know, I think because I had lived there and studied there and had these sort of ongoing connections, it was like I knew enough to know how much I didn't know. And for a long time, that was very, I think it was very intimidating to me. And it's funny, it was actually an Irish friend who, I was in Dublin and I was talking to an Irish friend and I said, you know, I've got this idea for a series set in Ireland, but I feel like I don't have the right to write it. I shouldn't write it. And she was so funny. She looked at me and she said, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And she started listing Irish writers who had written series set in America. And she said, you know, if so-and-so can do it, if so-and-so, you know, she just went through. And
in Maine in particular, if you think about Charlie Parker,
right, I mean, John, right, Connelly. Yeah. Like nobody better, right? Yeah, and right. So it was this incredibly freeing thing, you know, for her, for, you know, she grew up in Ireland and she loves Irish crime fiction. And she said, you know, you've got to do your research and we'll help you, but you should do it, you know? And so I think that, I think that kind of freed me, but it is, you know, and I do, I'm sure I get things wrong and I know things I've gotten wrong. And I, you know, I always just really try to come at it from Maggie's point of view, which is that of an American who's, you know, who loves Ireland, who has connections there and who's always learning about it. And that's me, you know. I lived there for years and went to graduate school there, but I was always an outsider because you are. And so I think bringing that perspective kind of helps to, I don't know, keep me humble probably and to make, you know, I do my research because I don't want to get things wrong.
But your point is good, that because you're doing the whole thing through a lens of an American in Ireland, not from an Irish person. And so you can make mistakes or, you know, not whatever because of that.
Yes, I can make some mistakes. Yeah.
Well, not geography and stuff. I mean, the obvious stuff, but cultural stuff, you know, you can get away with it because she's an outsider.
She can be naive. Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm going to sort of turn that around on you, Paul. And you write about a place where you live and where that you know really, really well, and where you have lots of connections. Do you ever find it hard to write you write about all sides of Maine, the beauty, the natural beauty, the sort of wonderful quality of the people, but you write about a really gritty side of Maine too, and about the, in some cases, kind of the worst of human nature. Do you ever struggle with kind of showing Maine in all of its, from all its angles?
It's been funny. I've always been unapologetic about that because I think partly because I worked at a magazine earlier in my career when I first was writing the books that really showcased the positive. And I loved the magazine. The work I did there, I'm very proud of, but I was, as somebody who grew up here, I just knew all this other stuff that just was never going to make it into Down East Magazine. But occasionally, yes, I get letters from readers who, or emails from readers who say, your experience of Maine is that you're describing in the books is just nothing like what the state that I know. You know, my wife and I moved up here from Connecticut 2 years ago, and we have not met anybody who acts that way. You're going to be scaring off the tourists, with these depictions of depraved, homicidal people in the woods. And my wife actually came up with this when she said, if Stephen King didn't do it, I'm not going to be the one.
Also
to...
find it.
He's, true. You know. Yeah. Yeah.
That's Maine cool. Seems to bring out, some really interesting and unusual writers, like Stephen King, as you point out, do you remember Jan Willem van Vettering? He was Dutch and yet wrote books about Maine. John Connolly, we've already mentioned. There's just a pretty nice woman whose name I can't, Sarah Graves, who has written books forever, set in Damariscotta, I think it is.
She sets it in Eastport, which is
Eastport. Yeah, right. I loved her first series. I really liked it a lot. And, but like a lot of series, eventually it kind of ran out of gas and it was time to do something different. So I think you've done really well keeping Mike alive and so interesting for 13 books. Sarah, you wrote an earlier series. Why did you decide to segue over here to this new series, which I really like? What was your impetus? Surely it was more than just Ireland.
It was, honestly, a lot of it was that I... became a parent in there, and I had three babies in 5 years, and was quite sort of occupied with that for a while, and it's funny, I was saying to somebody the other day that at the time it felt like a real failure that I couldn't keep up the pace of a book a year series, as a new parent, but as I look back on it, I think that I was also feeling kind of constrained by the amateur sleuth setup, which is what I wrote before. And I think that time when I was, focusing more on kids and not writing as much, and I did write a series of kids books in there, so I was writing those. I think I was storing up a lot of inspiration and creativity. And a lot of, you know, the Maggie series, I think a real through line in it is her attempts to be the best parent she can be while also, you know, excelling at her job. And that just the pain of that and the tension of that. And, you know, as we all know, it's one of the hardest things. And, you know, I don't think I could have written that without, you know, without sort of those years of thinking heavily about those topics. And then, you know, I really miss writing crime fiction and the, being able to kind of combine my love of Ireland and I was starting to spend a lot of time in Ireland again. And it just, you know, it sort of just came together, and it was a great way to kind of reintroduce myself, I guess, or to on-ramp back to crime fiction.
That's so interesting. Why crime fiction? Why is that so alluring to both of you? Maybe that should be my last question before Patrick pops back up again. Why does it grab you so?
I've recently talked to somebody about this, and so it's sort of fresh in my mind. I definitely, most of my books, not all of them, are mysteries in the sense that they're not rural noir, you know. In a noir book, the world is broken and it's the protagonist is sort of engaged in this existentialist struggle against meaninglessness to find some reason to go on and, you know, define justice on their own terms. A mystery, you know, the order is broken at the beginning of the book somehow, and it's by the end the reader expects some order to be returned, and that has always appealed to me. I don't think that's how way life is, but I think it's a compelling wish, I guess, for human existence. You know, we sort of hope for meaning and look for it and hope that we can kind of, you know, that there aren't mysteries that are, you know, remain unsolved at the end. So I actually really enjoy this. And in fact, one of the things that for the longest time puzzled me was that Amazon was categorizing my books as British mysteries. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, I mean, they take place entirely in Maine. There's a Maine game warden as the protagonist. I think they've redefined it as traditional mysteries. Mm-hmm. And it's like, ah, okay, now I understand why they were, you know, putting me in that category. So I don't know what appeals to you about it, Sarah, but that's my answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's all about sort of having the privilege of exploring character under these extreme circumstances, if that makes sense. You know, that I think of a criminal investigation as, and the events leading up to a criminal investigation, homicide, unnatural death, you know, it's like it reveals essential character. And to be able to kind of look at a cast of characters under that extreme pressure, hiding the secrets that they hide, and you know, trying to do, some of them trying to do the best they can, some of them, you know, perhaps responsible for the unnatural death. It just comes down to the characters for me. I just love exploring characters in that kind of a setup. And I think it gives you so much room and space to really delve into, you know, human motivation. And I love the extreme nature of a criminal investigation in order to do that.
That's a really fascinating answer. I think, Paul, at the moment, you know, considering the disorder that the world has fallen into, I think the idea of being able to take what is broken and, you know, and restore it in some way is enormously comforting right now. It's going to be interesting to see how the January 6th committee, which is, you know, basically a police procedural, you know, going on right in front of us. And, it, you know, it may be defeated by the fact that they will not be able to affect justice, even if they show us why we need it. I mean, you know, I think it's a really, I wish that I thought, I'm too old to live long enough to see what history is going to write about this country since 2016, but I think it'll be fascinating. I have lived long enough to know what we all thought about McCarthy. And here we are again, because, you know, I was born in 1940, so I went through the entire cycle of McCarthy and the blacklist by the time I was in college. And I think it'll be fascinating to see. You couldn't make up what's actually happened as a novelist.
You couldn't. The best fiction.
The other thing I will comment on in regard to Islands is that it is incredible to me how many books are based, or Agatha Christie's, you know, and then there were none, which, if you remember, had a really pejorative original title, which, yes, which I won't at the
which
moment.
Which will not be mentioned.
But nonetheless, that it's fascinating to me how many crime writers have come up with Islands as settings for the book. And I wonder in part if it's a reaction to the pandemic, you know, or it's, I mean, I don't know, but it's interesting how fiction kind of picks up something out of the zeitgeist and a lot of people explore it and, you know, and then move on to something else. And right now, that kind of isolation, you know, is part of what people are exploring, which I think may be a reaction to the pandemic. I don't know. Patrick, come join us and let us know if we have any questions from the audience. There he is.
All right. Yes. Let's see here. Well, our good friend Paula Meunier is watching. Another French.
Hi, Paula.
Another miniature author who lives in right. Hi, Paula. She'll be with us on July, I think it's the 20th for her book.
Coming right up. Okay, well, let's see. Paul, you've addressed this a little bit, but one of her questions is, so this is number 13 in the series. How do you keep it fresh? Mm-hmm. And then she says as she writes number 5 of her series.
Mm-hmm. I think it's always by, you know, the way that I start every book is I think to myself, okay, I don't come up with a high concept, you know. I start with where is Mike Bowditch personally and professionally after the last book? And logically, where should he be now? And where do I want him to end up at the end of this story? In terms of his own, you know, growth, or in some cases a step backwards. And I feel like that keeps me really honest in my stories, because I never lose sight of the fact that at the center of everything is being mediated through this narrator who's having these experiences and is being changed by them. That's the other thing, is unlike a lot of mysteries, series that I love, you know, there are consequences that ripple through from book to book. I mean, it's not like, you know, NCIS, where they've killed a bunch of people at the end of one episode and the next episode everything is copacetic, you know. So it's like, no, that's not the way life is.
So everything springs forth out of character, obviously. Yeah. Character first. Yeah. Let's see. Okay, Paula has a question for you, Sarah, and you've partially answered this, but she says, Sarah, Paul says he was inspired by and then there were none for this book. Is there a similar inspiration for you and the Drowning Sea?
That's a good question. You know, I don't know that there was and then there were none was probably also sort of tonally, there's something about that book that's the sort of confusion and the, you know, you feel like the characters are sort of in this fog of unknowing and constantly sort of looking over their shoulder. And I did want to capture a little bit of that. You know, my characters aren't on an island, but they're on this sort of remote peninsula. And there is a sense that it's someone who they know, you know, someone in their circle who may be responsible. And so, you know, that was probably an influence. Beyond that, certainly the Gothic elements in the house, you know, the novels like Rebecca and some of the you know, some of the work I did for my master's degree on Elizabeth Bowen and some other Irish writers was very influential. So it was kind of putting different things together.
What was that very famous? Because I remember reading an Elizabeth Bowen book. It's probably her, maybe her best known one.
The Last September is the one that,
that
people tend to know, which is a really interesting and complicated novel. I reread it recently, and every time I read it, I find new things that I hadn't noticed, and it's really something.
Paula also asks, are you going to move to Ireland too, Sarah? Would you if you could?
I'm not going to move to Ireland. I think my my husband and my kids would as much as they like Ireland, they would not, I don't think they would be up for that. No, we're pretty rooted here in Vermont, and I love living in Vermont. Ireland and Vermont are my two favorite places on the planet. I'd love to spend more time there than I do. And, you know, maybe that will be a part of my life at some point, you know, spending a couple months a year or something, if I could ever pull that off. But I love living in Vermont. So I think, you know, given a different life, if I had another life I could live, perhaps, but this one is pretty good in Vermont.
What is there a part of Ireland that I know it's a fairly small country, but that you haven't really explored yet that you would like to?
Yeah, you know, I've been to Northern Ireland a couple of times, but I really haven't explored it the way I've explored the Republic. And that's my next trip. I want to spend a lot of time in Northern Ireland. And I just, you know, it's an absolutely beautiful part of the island. And there's so much there that I want to learn more about. So I think it would be the north.
Let's see here. Oh yeah, I have to take issue to this cats are expendable comment, Barbara. I'm sorry.
I thought of you when I said that. I knew you wouldn't be happy with it. Nonetheless, I think pets in general, that mystery writers try. I mean, the dog is kind of the focus, but in general, yeah. I think that nobody really wants to kill the pet goat or the pet sheep or the, you know, or the loving cat or whatever it may
right.
be. People can be slaughtered, but not pets. I mean, it's kind
absolutely.
Of
not animals.
Let's see. Okay. Jerry just asked a question. Paul, you're on book 13. Do you have a chart to keep characters straight as you write about characters that started in book one and so on? How do you keep everything straight in your head?
Not as well as I should. Years ago, the writer Julia Spencer Fleming, who's a friend of mine, asked me over dinner, I was on book four or something, and she said, well, have you started a series Bible? And I didn't know what that was exactly, but she explained to me that it was, you know, a way that as a series grew, you recorded, okay, this character is 5'6" and has brown eyes, so that the next time you bring her in, she doesn't have green eyes. And at the time, I just thought this was a ridiculous concept. 13 books later, there have been a couple of continuity errors that, you know, pain me. And I've tried to get better at keeping everything straight, because it's a lot to hold in your head. I understand that George Martin has a super fan whom he employs to be his all-purpose knowledge resource of all of the various houses and everything. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I need, is I need a super fan.
Like, you get an intern to do.
Doesn't seem to be speeding up his output though, does it?
No.
No, but then he's busy producing The Dark Winds, you know, which I'm really happy to see that Tony's novels and Anne's combined are getting a new life on the screen. So
I have not seen that yet, but I'm very much looking forward to it.
It's a lot different than the first time around.
That's good.
Which I think is great. The only thing I wish they had were captions. It can be difficult to really understand some of the dialogue and you can watch it on, what is it, Fubo or something, and then AMC, but whatever, captions don't appear to be a feature. And I think that's kind of a shame. So I was going to drop Anne a note because she probably could introduce that.
Oh, yeah. Good question from Robin has just come in. She says, I love Sarah's books. The one thing about Sarah's first series that was extremely interesting was Sweeney's Occupation in Funerary Art. Mm. And that's also, Sarah, as you know, just wonderful cemeteries in Ireland. What was the one? Oh, my gosh. Is it called Glendalough?
You ever been there? So, yeah, I mean, Glendalough, which is an old monastery, the site of an old monastery in the Wicklow Mountains. There are two beautiful lakes, and it's just, it's a really peaceful spot. And, you know, it's one of those places where you stand there and you understand why these monks decided to settle there and contemplate their faith and nature. And there is a wonderful cemetery with some, you know, with very ancient stones, but then also with some more recent ones. That was the first time I really explored that cemetery. It was so interesting to find, you know, 20th century stones in there too. And it's a wonderful place.
But the funerary art was there. Where did that come from?
So the origin of that series was many years ago. I was at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and there was an exhibit of funeral jewelry and gloves that people had worn to funerals, and all of these sort of objects associated with the Victorian, you know, rite of mourning. And I stood there in the museum, and, you know, I was probably 22 years old, and I thought to myself, a detective who's an art historian specializing in funerary art, that would be a great series. And it took me a while to actually write it, but that's really where it came from. And it was so much fun, you know, living in New England, it was so much fun to write that series and, you know, visit the old cemeteries, the Puritan cemeteries we have here in New England.
Oh, yeah. Isn't it interesting how that stuff is fascinating? The Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Fashion Institute did a funerary exhibit as well. And it was really intriguing to, I remember going to it and I was fascinated by it. All the rituals of mourning.
Exactly. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, we don't have enough of those rituals today. I think depending on one's faith, you can either have a very beautifully laid out set of rituals or none at all. And it's hard to process death and loss without some kind of ritual.
I agree. I think grief, it requires it. I mean, that's, you know, it's helpful to have an estate to settle because it gives you things to do. I've just done two of them in the last 2 years, and it's a process that does help you, you know, work your way through it for sure. Anything else, Patrick?
Just as a very big digression, are you familiar with the Harlem Book of the Dead?
Not really. I feel like
a compendium. And it was about funeral photography in Harlem in the early part of the century, I believe, like up maybe into the 20s and something like that. Harlem Renaissance up to that period. And it's all photographs. Really amazing, fascinating book.
I think you're right. I feel like I've seen references to it, but I've never actually seen it. And, you know, death photography is a fascinating thing that we, you know, the Civil War kind of made it popular. And, for many people, the only time they were ever photographed in their lives was after they had died.
Yeah, for sure. There's the whole Victorian thing is fascinating because photography, what was it, about 1840, I think, when those first pictures were taken at Lake Hawk Abbey. And so it was a big thing. And, you know, the ability to capture. Wasn't Conan Doyle one of the people that thought that, you know, you could capture the person's soul in the in the photograph? Yeah, maybe that, not Matt Doyle, but, you know, he was really into all of that after his son died.
He spent the rest of his life
trying to process that.
And the spiritualist movement is right around that same time, too.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating area. So let's wind up then and ask you what you're working on. I always like to leave people in hope that they're going to get another book. So Paul, is there going to be a 14?
Oh, yes. Yes, it's well underway. It's due in the fall, and I'm well into it. I'm trying to think about anything that I could give as a tidbit, but
You don't have to. I just like readers to be able to know that there will be another book.
There will be, yes, and it is part of the
series. What about you, sir?
So I've just turned in Maggie number 4, and she's in Dublin this time, and it was really fun. I sort of focused on one Dublin neighborhood, and kind of the history and the people of this neighborhood, and it was fun to write. I hope it'll be fun to read too.
I'm sure it will be. Well, that's exciting for all you fans to know that you've got treats in store. Exciting for me because I'm a fan of both these books, of both these authors, rather, and their series, also these particular books. So let me remind you that we do have autographed copies, both of Paul's book, Hatchet Island, and Sarah's book, The Drowning Sea, although, as Patrick pointed out, not a whole lot of them left. So don't delay. It'll be perfect 4th of July reading, right? Anyway, guys, it was lovely to see you. I always look forward to the end of June when I get to talk to you. So thank you. We'll do it again. Maybe we can do it before we get to the end of June if we can find something suitable to do. Maybe we should all gang up on Archer.
I would absolutely be in.
That would sort of be fun. You know, see if you're free on September 29th and let me know. It'll be like 9:30 your time because he's all engaged in, you know, he has multiple careers as a EMT and a firefighter and, you know, volunteer policeman and all. So he can only do events when he's not actually on duty.
Yeah.
So that's when he's not on duty. It's 9:30 at night, but that'd be fun, you know.
Zoom bomb him.
Yeah, let me know. That'd be great. Maybe we can work that out. Anyway, good night, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. There is a live event at the Poison Pen at 7:00. Dan Patrick will be running because I'm not able to walk down there at the moment.
Yeah.
But and then we have a live event on Wednesday night with Julie Clark, which will be fun. So it's nice that real live events are actually starting again. So maybe next June we can get you back to Phoenix. That'd be fun. Never mind that it will be 110.
Oh, I don't care.
You have excellent air conditioning, as I remember.
We do. Right. We have fabulous air conditioning, and we do dinner, so it'll all work out. Anyway, good night, everybody.
Thank you, Barbara. Me. Thank you, Patrick.
You bet.
Thank you. Pleasure. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.